in the group that I co-chair on the Aging Analyst, we've talked a lot about what difference it makes having practiced a long time. And one of the ideas that emerges is not only does this vary from person to person, but there's a lot more freedom to use somewhat different approaches, less rigid, less specifically theory focused, and that the role of life experience certainly changes what you hear and how you hear it.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years, and have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Malka Notman. Dr. Notman is a training and supervising analyst at the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, and she's a professor at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Notman has been practicing psychoanalysis for over 55 years, and it's that experience that is the focus of our conversation today. We talk about what the field has been and what it's becoming. We talk about how she has changed. We discuss what it's like to live through periods of history and how that does and doesn't impact how one listens and engages with patients. The leitmotif of Dr. Notman's work, which is clear to anyone who knows her and who's read her work, and also in my speaking with supervisees of hers, that there's a common sense practicality to her thinking that's refreshing. It's theoretically free, and it focuses on what's the patient's felt experience. How do we hear that? And from that, how do we understand it? There isn't an interface between she and the patient that's theory bound. She's not limited to what you're supposed to be hearing. She's interested in what the patient's experience is and also how it impacts her. We discuss this. We also close with discussing her view of psychoanalysis and where it is now, where it is going. She has some questions, some cautions, and some perspective based on her many years of practicing. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Malka Notman. Malka, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you're with us today. Malka, when I was a resident in training in the late 70s, there was a senior attending who was reflecting on the learning of psychotherapy to a group of us. And he sat back and he said, you know, learning psychotherapy is really an old man's game. Now, for the moment, let's put aside the gender reference, because in the 70s, it was mostly a male field. But what I took him to mean was that it really takes a lot of clinical experience to know how to do this work well. I also took him to mean that it takes a lot of life experience to know how to do this well. And I also thought that he was saying that age allows one to step back a bit from the pressures of one's impulses, one's drives, to engage in what we would now call reverie. That's what I understood his message about it being an old person's game was. Malka, you're 93. You've been practicing psychoanalysis for over 56 years. And you've had a number of foci in your life, a number of areas that have been of great interest to you that we're going to spend time today. You certainly have been interested in female psychology, in particular, the meaning of the woman's body. You've been interested in psychiatry and the interface between psychoanalysis and psychiatry. You were an acting chair of the Department of Psychiatry for 4 years. And a leitmotif of what I've understood to be your mindset about our field is how important it is to learn from what you hear from the patient, not presuming what you should hear. That is, your focus is on in vivo listening and not on theory. Malka, tell us what our field of psychoanalysis looks like to you at this point, and we'll eventually get walked through over the decades that you've been involved in it. But what does it look like now?
Well, it's quite variable. For one, there's a multiplicity of ideas and theories. I think what my experience was in training was that you had to fit whatever you heard from a patient into the prevailing theoretical model. I'm also doing a study of women at BPSI, at my analytic institute.
That's the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute.
Yeah. And the experience of the women who trained early, not quite my peers, but a little later, was that those who succeeded were able to discard what they felt was a non-relevant or non-helpful theory. So the idea of listening to patients has been around for a while. Sometimes one feels inadequate because you can't make it fit. My experience has been that I've really learned more from patients all through the years. And I have sympathized with and empathized with people, analysts, who have tried to make theory conform to what they actually hear and understand from patients. I think psychoanalysis now is also practiced in a fairly wide range of different ways. In the group that I co-chair on the Aging Analyst, we've talked a lot about what difference it makes having practiced a long time. And one of the ideas that emerges is not only does this vary from person to person, but there's a lot more freedom to use somewhat different approaches. Less rigid, less specifically theory focused, that the role of life experience certainly changes what you hear and how you hear it. Some of the issues that have come up have been what kind of transference effect does aging have? The concept of the erotic transference, how much does that change with the aging of the analyst? And also,
have you come to any conclusions about that?
I think it's variable. Some of us, some people I've talked to feel it has really changed a fair amount, that it's less likely, but others find that that's not true. It's possible to have the transference really not pay so much attention to the actual reality. I think the role of time and the perception of time, the analyst's perception of how much time he or she has affects, I think, how one practices to some extent. And I find that in some patients who return for either a consultation or another period, that I am freer to do more psychotherapy, including occasionally making suggestions, which really were not part of any analytic practice or training.
Do you think that's because you're older and you know the meanings and impact and reverberations of making suggestions, or it's because you're no longer engaged in an analytic process, and so whatever interference suggestions might bring to the treatment, that's not relevant for what the person is trying to do right now in their treatment?
I think it's not relevant to whatever I think the person needs at the time.
Right, right. I guess the question is, back when you had first seen them in analysis, whether now you would have thought there still could have been a place for suggestion.
I don't think so. Well, I think it varies with the individual. I think there were patients where there were moments within the analysis where I would feel that a suggestion, like to consider something, or once or twice there was a medical problem. Somebody had gone skiing and was complaining, and I really felt it needed a medical workup. And, suggestions of that sort that were not so much within the treatment, do this or do that, but to consider some aspect of reality.
Does your freedom to make suggestions now, do you think it's built upon your being so well trained in the basics? There's an old saying that the best jazz improvisers are those who trained classically and really know the scales thoroughly. And once you know it, then you can play with it. Do you think that applies to your situation and others who've been around for a while?
To some extent. I think to some extent it is an assessment of what is needed. I don't feel it characterizes every treatment. It's really within certain treatments. And I think that often the person who comes back, that it becomes psychotherapy rather than a kind of extension of analysis. And in that context, I think a suggestion is different. I don't think I would say all of what I do is influenced by that.
Almost 30 years ago, I had contacted you and asked you if you would write a chapter for a book I was editing. And this is a book that was focused on learning psychotherapy for psychiatric residents, which I was involved in the training of, and also for psychology students and social work students. And the chapter you wrote is called The Self as a Clinical Instrument. Now, again, we're going back 30 years, and I can tell you I still teach this chapter today to residents, and it is still one of the most liked and studied chapters of all the chapters in the book. And that's because you have this ability to take complex subjects and speak in English. I mean, it's part of, I guess, your disregard is too strong. You're turning away from theory and to focus on the human experience. Just a couple of samples from the chapter. You talk, and again, these are for trainees. You say, empathy is a means of understanding another person's feelings through resonance with one's own feelings. It depends on the capacity to use one's personal experience to appreciate someone else's feelings and perceptions. This does not mean simply being sympathetic or offering support or making a patient feel good. Rather, an empathic relationship involves achieving understanding through one's own connection with the other person's experience. Now, that's such a lovely, simple, clear explanation of a rather nuanced concept that the residents I teach respond very well to. But you go further. In this chapter, you talk about things that are obviously current today. You talk about the importance of appreciating similarities or differences between therapist and patient when it comes to race, gender, class, and cultural background. You were, needless to say, ahead of your time with that. But you go further. Again, focusing on the lived experience, you say, even physical differences affect one's body image and determines one's view of the world. A small person can feel vulnerable and out of place among larger ones. A large person can feel awkward and ungainly, particularly if those around him or her are small. That kind of attention to the lived experience is what characterizes your writing and how you practice. And then you add this wonderful sentence, which is so powerful for trainees. You say, to be truly helpful is not compatible with always being liked, which of course is a real challenge for students. And you say it in such a clear way. Michael, what has enabled you to be so tuned in to not what you're supposed to hear, not what theory orients you to, but to your ability to listen to the person?
I don't know that I can really answer that, except that some pursuit of what really felt real has always been very important to me. And the theory of, you know, empathy, of understanding of the actual experience of the other person fits with my very early interest in biology as explaining life. You know, turned out it wasn't quite enough, but that same orientation, you know, it led me into not only understanding the patient's feelings or the resident's feelings, but what applications it might have. You know, one of my current colleagues, who was a supervisee, and describes that he told me at the beginning of his residency that he felt he wasn't doing anything. He wasn't getting any patients. They were not coming. And he felt just lost. And what he remembers is that what I said to him was that he would then remember and be able to understand a patient who came to him with that same dynamic, feeling lost. I think that's an example. But also, I found that same approach was very useful for me when we were all doing consult liaison as part of our training, and I then became the psychiatrist who was the consultant to OBGYN at the Beth Israel, which I did for some years. And it was in the course of that I realized that the obstetricians and gynecologists who were effective, they were good doctors, you know, in their fields, but they often really didn't understand what was going on with the patient. That this was particularly true for some gynecological situations where they would have their idea, but it didn't include what the patient felt. So I began to be interested in women's issues and the body through that experience. And I started to write some things, hoping to educate psychiatrists, if not analysts. There were just not a lot of analysts paying attention to those issues either.
Again, your focus is on what the patient felt. But as your supervisee said, let me read you a note that I had received. We have a colleague in common who had heard about this upcoming conversation between us, and he wrote me the following. She is a wonderfully pragmatic analyst with her feet well anchored in the realities of life. I was assigned to her as my supervisor when a first-year resident. My immigration papers had not yet come through, and so I could not see patients. I arrived to meet her, hoping for much needed sympathy. She looked at me and said, "So you're unemployed. Hold on to this experience. For your whole career, you will see unemployed patients. This will help you to understand who they are." Quote, that, he says, is Malka.
Yeah.
I mean, what you're really suggesting is that we live our lives and we notice the lives we're living and we use that to inform our experience of being with another person to understand how they are living their life and see both the similarities and differences and to understand the nuances of how they're living their life. What a wonderful description of psychoanalysis, yeah?
There is also an advantage to having lived through many periods of life, not just personal, but historical, that gives you some perspective into which to place an understanding of a patient. You know, looking back on what it felt like when there were certain opportunities or certain relationships closed off, you know, the feminist issue is influenced by the anti-Semitic issue, and that is influenced by the racial issues, you know, the sense of being excluded, not valued, I think runs across all these experiences. You know, just a little political piece. I heard Merrick Garland, you know, our new Attorney General, comment on the current racial crises around the police violence. And he was recalling his experience as being the child of Holocaust survivors. And that sense of what the danger of being the other, he generalized in a way that I found quite understandable and very similar to what my perception was. I think in analysis, you also, in analytic experience, you also get a sense of that sense of not fitting from a range of patients. It's not racial or generational or political. And I think some of my interest in the trans experience recently is what people describe as not fitting, you know, as not belonging to the classical or standard concept of gender. And there's a lot that I feel I don't understand about that. And I think where it fits with my ideas of female development and what we might need to change in the classical theories, but still the thing that is the element that I feel is similar and enables some empathic understanding is the sense of not fitting, and not only one's internal sense of not fitting, but other people having that idea and giving that impression, so that you not fit, you know, as a woman, as a sort of identified man, or, you know, the universal feeling that I hear from racially different patients. And it isn't only black, white, but, you know, the Asian resident, Chinese resident, who talks about that feeling in her resident from her patients. You know, it is a universal issue. And, you know, apropos aging, there was a way in which becoming old, you know, losing your changing your physical appearance, can seem like one more way of entering a marginalized group. You know, you don't have to be Black or Chinese or whatever. By the very fact of changing your class, really. So there are some of these universal issues.
Would you say that one of the differences between the early years of your training and practice and now is that it was understood, tell me if you think this is correct, it was understood in development that everybody goes through some painful experience of being the other. We are ultimately the other in our families, no matter how accepted and responded to and loved we are another. We are excluded from various scenarios, and we are always small and inadequate and in some way self-deprecating about our otherness universally in childhood, in families. And now that is being approached through social identifications. One is an other from race, from culture, from gender identification, from wealth, et cetera. And whether something's gained and something lost by perhaps not appreciating that it isn't simply a social dimension, it's also a universal developmental step that everybody goes through that is now being linked to these various social phenomena. Do you think that that change over time, A, do you think it's accurate? And B, what do you think about the pros and cons of emphasizing one or the other?
Of that idea?
Yeah.
Well, no, I think there are the pros are the humanistic values. The cons are that I think sometimes universalizing something doesn't permit effective action to deal with the genuine problems, exclusions, persecutions. Mm-hmm.
The social aspects and right, okay. Mm-hmm.
Or the psychological aspects, that is the current dialogue or discussion about hate. It's a social phenomenon, a political phenomenon, but a psychological phenomenon. And something of, I mean, universalizing, I think, is important, but to deal with the sources of it politically or effectively needs to happen. So you can't just say it happens to everybody. You have to say it happens more to some people in some situations, and it's promoted more by some social political forces. So, you know.
And the particular ways it happens to particular groups.
Yeah, and at particular times in history.
And when that comes up in treatment, how do you approach it? I just had an interesting conversation about the issue of climate change and how one approaches that. Again, that's an outside reality. And the same question lends itself to the othering that's going on about so many groups and so many individuals, and how one as an analyst inside the office and outside the office approaches these literal social and emotional challenges that are other than what's the inner meaning of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think as an analyst, the other element, I mean, I think the social, the empathic, the political understanding is very important. But I think the internal countertransference aspects are also very important. I mean, you can't just generalize, you know, this is good, this is bad. I think as an analyst, you have to also think, how does it really affect me? You know, what particular elements in my own experience? You know, what comes to my mind is an analytic patient I had one time who was, she started out as a referral from a colleague as a psychiatrist. So, and a woman having problems, you know, in her training. So, of course, it hit the social and personal areas that I was sympathetic to. And it was complicated working with her for a lot of reasons. One of them was that it turned out she was addicted to heroin. And to get her off heroin, then she became a compulsive eater. And to get her away from that. So, you know, it's a complicated, long process. But the thing that I felt the most sort of affronted by was she lived in a community, a well-to-do community, some, you know, distance from mine, but not all the way. And they were deliberating community town rules as well as state rules that had to do with funding for schooling. And she was unmarried and didn't have kids. And she was viciously campaigning against using town money for schools, you know, on the basis of, I can't remember exactly what, but, you know, it was a group that had its.
Right.
That somehow got me more than
I can feel
the
it.
Addiction the eating disorder, you know. And I, you know, I was sort of shocked by that, to realize, you know, that I had no objectivity in that area at all. My kids were in public schools, you know, which played a role. But there's also...
Sure.
It was, so why that got to me, you know, I found very illuminating.
Did you have any sense that on some level it was intentional, that she was trying to get to you and your
no,
motherness?
No, I didn't have that sense because it was so general, you know, and she may have, it may have been intentional. It didn't feel that way, but it felt that it touched something in me that was clearly countertransference and beyond reality, although I would defend my position. And that was interesting.
You would defend your position in the treatment?
Not in the treatment, no. But I mean, I would defend my position as valuing schools. And
right.
But and not in the treatment. There was, you know, I really tried to understand where her position came from. And it had dynamics in her own development. She had been a kind of favorite only child and was then greeted with twin sisters who really took over, and she resented them enormously. So it had that source, but that didn't have much to do with me. But the idea that your general social position, which can be righteous and morally correct and all of that, has some roots internally, I think is very important.
How apropos, you describe the importance and the meaning of living through different eras of history and how that may reverberate with the clinical setting. We, of course, have lived through and are, to some extent, living through a tumultuous, highly politicized time in our countries, not just our countries in the world, but especially in the States. And I think the question of how one engages in the politics that we have been surrounded by, if not drowning in, over the past numbers of years, has changed for many.
Yeah.
I have colleagues who... are generally hold themselves as very abstinent in terms of revealing much about themselves. And I've heard them talk over these recent years where they're front and center with their patients about how they think about the American politics, which interested me. What's your view of how things have changed, and are there advantages to how it's changed?
Well, I think there is a greater involvement of analysts in politics. I think the perception of the Trump era as violating human values and not only truth and science and respect for others has been so perceived as so extreme that it warrants positions against it in various ways. And some of these are political, some of these are just support of organizations that stand for other values. I don't actually know analysts personally who have not taken any position. I know a number of people who don't take public positions, but I think the ideas, maybe it's just my narrow group, but I think the idea is that it is important to take some positions when you really feel violations of important human values and, you know, has changed.
And when you say take positions, do you mean in the office with patients?
No, I mean, or in taking supporting groups, even.
I know, I understand that. Yeah. Sure. But what about in the office?
In the office, I've been challenged by a few patients. You know, when Trump came into office, there was a lot of essentially disappointment and horror. And there are a few patients who have family members who are Trump supporters. And I have stayed away from taking positions, you know, in regard to that issue for them. I mean, let them work it out. I think if patients express their reactions, such as pleasure in the political success, I'll agree with that. I have not really dealt with some of their conflicts around the Trump supporting relatives.
I get the sense that your patients themselves have not had politics at great variance with yours.
No, you know, what comes to my mind is a patient who had developed breast cancer, and she had an oncologist that she was referred to that she thought was pretty good, but she wondered if this guy was a Trump supporter, and she felt she would not go to him, oncologist or not, if he was really a Trump supporter. She didn't find out, and so it didn't become that kind of conflict, but that's the kind of conflict patients have.
Had she known about your sentiments about this?
Well, pretty much everybody in the academic community knows, you know, and at the time, the New England Journal of Medicine, you know, of which I read the social aspect, came out with a very strong anti-Trump position, saying they could not support that the physician organization couldn't support such bad policy for medicine. And, you know, that was pretty well known.
Monica, your perspective, having lived so long in our field, allows us to take a glimpse into the past, but perhaps you're also, from that history, able to imagine the future. Why don't we approach it by the future you would like it to be and the future that you otherwise imagine it will be? What do you see psychoanalysis becoming in the next decades?
Well, we just got a letter from the BPSI president who is ending his terms, and BPSI has, in the last period, flourished. And including having more candidates and more fellows than for some time before. So that, in the face of all the political problems, seems like a good sign. My own sense is that I think inevitably psychoanalysis needs to move to more of a big tent approach, including various groups, but sustaining some sense of differentiation between the real analytic training and issues. And I wonder if that would get lost.
So by big tent, do you mean inviting people who are not analysts under the umbrella of the American Psychoanalytic? Is that,
to
is
be
that
able
the big
to
tent reference?
Participate in psychoanalytic discussions.
I see. Okay. But maintaining a distinction between those who have actually had psychoanalytic training and those who have not. I see.
Yeah. But, you know, for instance, I was a council member when Newell Fisher was the president of APSA. And he worked very hard to get APSA to admit analysts with, quote, substantially similar training. I mean, that was a big discussion. What is substantially similar training? And it ended up, after several years, with APSA admitting the people trained in the White Society and other groups. And it's turned out to be perfectly okay, you know, but the process of giving up one's special sense and recognizing that other people share important aspects of how they see things took a lot of doing. So I think a similar amount of both opening up and suspicion would go on with, quote, the big tent. And I'm not sure how to define it, but I think it has to go that way, in that to get psychoanalytic thinking and really, you know, it has already penetrated like economics, you know, where the idea that all decisions are rational has really gone, been given away.
Mm-hmm.
Awareness of unconscious motivation. But I think the way in which people with analytic orientation and not analytic training need to be welcomed as participants in some aspects of the analytic world, I think just has to happen. But how to keep the specialness, I don't know that I have really thought about the answer to that, but I think it is a concern.
It's the familiar tension between, between, for example, the outside and the inside.
And how
the literalness and,
you know, the resentment of who is felt like the inferior.
Yeah, it has always struck me as strange that we analysts who are so focused on helping people appreciate similarities and differences that aren't necessarily hierarchical.
Yeah.
I mean, the differences between the genders, the differences between the generations, the differences between skill sets. There are differences, and we're all different. That there are people who can become part of the big tent, as you say, and obviously have a great deal to contribute. And at the same time, they have differences because, let's say, they haven't had a personal analysis or they haven't worked with people in analysis. That one should be able to acknowledge that there are differences without saying somebody's inferior or someone's superior. Now, I get it, that touches on universal inclinations, that when we have a bad day, we tend to take differences and turn them into superiorities. But those are bad days, and we shouldn't be having so many bad days. We should be able to manage that, is my thought about it.
Yeah, I agree. I think some of this has a historical element in the need to define analysis or analysts as having something special. You know, I had a personal period of this in that when I was first in analytic training in the, I think it's the late 50s, 58, 59, I could not deduct my analytic expense as a tax deduction that improved my status as a psychiatrist, because the American Psychoanalytic at the time said, we really are a special field. It's not a bit improving psychiatry. And the Candidates Council sued and won. And we were then allowed to deduct.
Sue the IRS.
Yeah. But the idea that we were so special, you know, had some historical need to define psychoanalysis as new and special. That was not true in Boston. And, you know, I'm now writing this history of women in in Boston. And very interesting that the original people were brought in, psychiatrists, neurologists, psychologists. You know, William James was an important member of that group. So it's there are various histories that contribute to some of these ideas.
Well, there's no question that there are long stretches of our history that were ruled by hierarchies that that did, in fact, differentiate people and disrespected people. There's no question about that. And we've come a long way, and we have longer to go. And the challenge for us is to be aware of, A, our history, B, what we're capable of in terms of changing that history, and also staying, staying aware of the inner meanings of those histories in terms of each of our lives, as you point out, both in our current lives and in our past lives. And that stays true. I took a note, and a theme in everything that I hear you saying, Malka, is focusing on what the patient felt.
Yeah.
That's your contribution to our work, to listen to the patient. Don't listen to the theory. Don't listen to the social hierarchies that are being sold as truth. Just listen to the patient's experience.
You have to add a little something, which is how you understand the patient's experience also needs to be thought about. And you have to listen, but you have to also try to understand it. So that's where your current theory comes into effect.
Malka, you first of all, thank you for meeting and speaking. We had our technical difficulties to arrange this, and I'm delighted we've overcome this and we were able to spend time together. You've, from all 30 years ago when you wrote that chapter for my book that is still current today, from the impression you have left on so many people, patient society, even your supervisees, the people you have taught, your truth of listening to yourself and to them, and thank you for correcting and adding, to understand what you listen to, is what you have brought to the field, both in terms of the listening and appreciating the biology, understanding what it means to be a woman in this field, understanding medical needs, and understanding aging now. Your thinking is so present and is so in vivo and fresh that it feels so alive. And I'm sure everyone that you're in contact with has the same impression, not only as I, but as the people we've been quoting today.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for speaking with me. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.